thank you so much, and I want to tell you first how happy I am to be here in Berkhamsted. I've been very impressed by the school. Now I will read the despair of Graham towards the school in another, with another eye, because I thought it was, reading him, I thought it was a shabby place. It's far from a shabby place, it's a wonderful place. Anyhow, I hope you will forgive my French accent and my occasional Irish brogue. Now, the title of my paper does not refer to the kidnapped British Honorary Consul Charles Fortnum, eponymous hero of the thriller published by Graham Greene in 1973. It concerns my friendship with the grand old man of English letters. We first met in 1971, 2 years exactly before I was appointed Honorary Consul of Ireland, in 1973, precisely the year where Graham published the book that he considered as his best novel. In the early 1970s, we were both living in the Résidence des Fleurs, an apartment block overlooking the harbour of Antibes in the south of France. I was completing my PhD on the two Irish constitutions and the politics of Ireland, and in order to be aware of what was going on in Ireland in north and south, I was relying not on Irish newspapers, which I couldn't get in the south of France, but on the London Times. And on 26 November 1971, I was thrilled to read a letter to the editor of the Times, written by my illustrious neighbour in the Résidence des Fleurs. He denounced the sensory deprivation techniques known euphemistically as clean torture, deployed on 14 internees in the army base in County Derry in Northern Ireland. The letter to the editor of the Times was so revealing of the style and position of Graham Greene that it's so faithful to his frame of mind that, if you will allow me, I will quote it in full. He starts like this: "To be at the same time a Catholic and an Englishman is today to be ashamed on both counts. As a Catholic, one is ashamed that more than 1,000 years of Christianity has not abated the brutality of those Catholic women who shaved a young girl's head and poured tar and red lead over her body because she intended to marry an English soldier. As an Englishman, the shame is even greater. Deep interrogation, a bureaucratic phrase which takes the place of the simple word torture, and is worthy of Orwell 1984, is on a different level of immorality from hysterical sadism of the indiscriminating bomb of the urban guerrillas. It is something organized with imagination and a knowledge of psychology, calculated and cold-blooded, and it is only half condemned by the Compton investigation." Mr. Maudling was the Minister for Home Affairs at the time, in his blithe, jolly style, reminiscent of that used by defenders of corporal punishment when they remember their school days, suggests that no one has suffered permanent injury from this form of torture by standing long hours pressed against a wall, hooded in darkness, isolated and deprived of hearing as well as sight by permanent noise, prevented in the intervals of the ordeal from sleep. These were the methods we condemned in the Slansky trials in Czechoslovakia and in the case of Cardinal Mitzenti in Hungary. Slansky is dead. He cannot be asked by Mr. Maudling how permanent was the injury he suffered. But one would like to know the opinion of the Cardinal on methods which, when applied by communists or fascists, we call torture, and when applied by the British, becomes downgraded to ill treatment. If I, as a Catholic, were living in Ulster today, I confess I would have one savage and irrational ambition: to see Mr. Maudling pressed against a wall for hours on end, with a hood over his head, hearing nothing but the noise of a wind machine, deprived of sleep when the noise temporarily ceases by the bland voice of a politician telling him that his brain will suffer no irreparable damage. The effects of these methods extend far beyond the border of Ulster. How can any Englishman now protest against torture in Vietnam, in Greece, in Brazil, in the psychiatric wards of the USSR, without being told you have double standard, one for others and another for your own country? And after all the British tortures and the Catholic outrages, what comes next? We all know the end of the story, however long the politicians keep up their parrot cries of no talk until violence ends. When I was young, it was the same cliché they repeated. Collins was a gunman and a thug. We will not talk to murderers. No one doubts that it was in our power then to hold Ireland by force. The Black and Tans matched the Republicans in terror. It was the English people who, in the end, forced the politicians to sit down at a table with the gunmen and the thug. Now, too, when the death and the torture have gone on long enough to blacken us in the eyes of the world and to sicken even a conservative of the right, there will inevitably be a temporary truce and a roundtable conference. Mr. Modling or his successors will sit down over the coffee and the sandwiches with representatives of AIR and Stormont, of the IRA and the Provisional IRA, to discuss with no preordained conditions changed in the constitution and in the border of Ulster. Why not now rather than later? End of quote. On that very same day, I found myself face to face with Graham in our communal basement, both with dustbins in hand. I gathered up my courage and congratulated him warmly on his letter. We had a long, friendly chat in the stairs. Graham was surprised to find a young Frenchman not only able to speak English fluently, but also well-versed in Irish history and politics. He immediately invited me to take a drink at his apartment on the fourth floor of the Résidence des Fleurs. It was the beginning of a friendship which was to last from 1971 to 1990. We met two or three times a month in our respective apartments and later on the Villa Dina in the Parc Sarah Martel at Les Chênes Verts on the Boulevard JF Kennedy in the Cap d'Antibes, my family house where I moved in 1983, but also to the Auberge Provençale on the Place Nationale or chez Félix, the restaurant on the harbour where Graham and Yvonne Cloetta had lunch practically every day when in Antibes. We had long discussions about Henry James, Conrad, Ford Madox Ford, George Bernanos, G.K. Chesterton, and Norman Douglas, who were among his favorite writers. We would also discuss the dissolution of the USSR and Gorbachev's efforts to modernize his crumbling state by eliminating the most totalitarian aspects of the communist regime. After Perestroika and Glasnost, Graham felt a strong desire to visit Russia again after 20 years of absence. He received an invitation from the Writers' Union in 1985, which he accepted, and on September 1986, even Cloetta and himself made a long journey, not only to Moscow, but also to Georgia, the Black Sea, Siberia, and other places. While in Moscow, the couple visited Graham's friend and former colleague of the Secret Intelligence Service, although after what we have heard this morning, I wonder if we should call it the not-so-secret and not-so-intelligence service. Now, Kim Philby, who had defected to Russia in November 1962, shortly before being uncovered as a Soviet spy. Actually, I never took notes of my various talks and encounters with Graham. Only once did I take notes. It was after a discussion with Graham about his visit to Philby. According to my notes, it is chez Félix on the 15th of December 1986 that Graham told me about his meeting with Philby. On the front page of my notes, I have scribbled the words strictly confidential, as the author of The Human Factor did not want to find in the papers any information on what he considered as a strictly private visit. In revealing them, I do not feel that I am now betraying any secrets, as both Rufina Philby and Yvonne Cloetta have recounted the event in great details in their respective books, which are for sale up there. Graham was asked if he wanted to see Philby. His answer was forthright. He knows I am here. Therefore, if he wants to see me, he will have to make the first move. An invitation to dinner was forwarded to Graham and Yvonne by Kim Philby and his wife. Graham accepted on the condition that it would not be in a public place and that there would be no witness. Graham was anxious to meet his old friend, but as time passed, he became disturbed and hesitant. He was intimidated, says Yvonne. When they rang the bell of the apartment, Graham was nervous. Philby opened the door. They stared at each other, ill at ease, not knowing what to say. Then Philby broke the silence. "Well, it is obvious that a lot of water has flowed by." And he added immediately, "Please, Graham, don't ask me any questions about the past." The evening was spent in discussing trivialities, but it was sufficient for Graham to see that Kim had not gone native and was still the quintessential Englishman that he had always been. The next day, they saw each other again. Yvonne said to Philby that he looked very, very tired. He confessed that he had not slept at all the previous night. "Having the opportunity to meet a friend like Graham, whom I have not seen for over 20 years, how could I possibly sleep?" he said. "Is it true," I asked Graham, "that he missed England and the English way of life?" Graham answered that he could not be certain. "He seems to be happy in Moscow. He has married Rufina, a Russian woman younger than he is. She is very, very devoted to him. She has succeeded in making him smoke and drink less. A great performance, as he was a very heavy drinker, which was very bad for his emphysema. But during our visit to Moscow," says Graham, "there was no restriction as far as the drinks were concerned. Vodka flowed in abundance during the 3 days we saw each other." "Do you think that he is still active in the KGB?" I ventured to ask. "I don't know," said Graham. "He may have played a role of advisor under the reign of Andropov. Under Gorbachev, it is difficult to guess if he is still operational or not. Whatever may be the case, he has no regrets." However, the description of the miserable fate of in Moscow of the Soviet mole Morris Castle in The Human Factor, published in 1978, shows that Graham had serious doubts about Philby, who may very well have been considered as a spent force and sidelined by his KGB handlers. On the fourth floor of the Residence des Fleurs, Graham Greene would often reminisce with me about his earlier wanderings in places like Mexico, Haiti, Cuba, Paraguay, and Argentina. He spoke with particular warmth of his friendship with Omar Torrijos, the ruler of Panama, and the unexpected invitation he got from him in 1976. He was perturbed by the situation in Nicaragua. He laughed heartily when I told him that while in Haiti, we made our pilgrimage to the Hotel Olofsson, guided there by none other than Aubelin Jolicoeur, on whom he modeled the prying journalist and police informer Petit Pierre of his 1966 novel, The Comedians. On Southeast Asia, I took great care, as a Frenchman, to record precisely what he once confessed to me. I took a great interest in Vietnam, where I spent longer spells than in Central America. At the time of the French War, I came back 2 months every winter for about 4 years running. In Vietnam, I had a sympathy, in a sense, for both sides. I was able to see Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi, and as an ex-colonialist, I had a certain sympathy with the French, which I didn't have later with the Americans, who had come from so far away and who had no knowledge of the country. At least, the French knew what they were fighting for. One should not think that we were always talking endlessly. Often we sipped our drinks quietly, happy to be together. I introduced him to 12-year-old Jameson Irish whiskey, for which he developed a liking, while he shared his recipe for his extra dry martinis. I'm going to give you the recipe because I think it's a very useful insight in the psyche of our friend. Put some Neuprat with ice cubes in a glass, stir for 30 seconds, then empty the vermouth and ice and fill the frozen glass right to the brim with gin. I recommend you the recipe, it's absolutely lethal. Graham once invited me to drink miniature bottles of vodka and aquavit, which were given to him on a Scandinavian airline. He smiled when I said that we were like James Wormald and Captain Segura in Our Man in Havana. Needless to say, I stopped before falling asleep like the Cuban army officer in the novel. I asked Graham if I could interview him on Ireland, his life in the south of France, and various other subjects. Even though he was notoriously hostile to any forms of interviews, he spontaneously accepted, and he may even have enjoyed the experience. A long interview entitled Graham Greene's Other Ireland was eventually published in the December 1981 issue of Études Irlandaises, the Journal of Irish Studies, of which I was at the time editor. It was reissued in the Irish press on the 26th of March 1982, in the Irish Independent dated July 1st, 1989, and in two collections of articles published in the United States, Conversations with Graham Greene, edited by Henry Donaghy and published by University Press of Mississippi in 1992, and Graham Greene, Man of Paradox, edited by A.F. Cassis and published in Chicago by Loyola University Press in 1994. Although four of his books had been banned by the Irish censor, he was extremely fond of Ireland. With a cousin, he walked from Dublin to Waterford in 1923, shortly after the end of the Civil War. If you read his book, Reflections, one of the first essays is about Dublin at that time, and it's a very precious picture of the capital of Ireland just after this sad civil war, with the shambles, the misery, and the ruins caused by this unfortunate event. In the late 40s, he got into the habit of holidaying on Achill Island in the west of Ireland, where Catherine Wollstone, the flamboyant wife of the millionaire British Member of Parliament Harry, later Lord Wollstone, and the great passion of his life at the time, had a little fisherman's cottage with no electricity and an outside tap for the water. There, he became a close friend of Ernie O'Malley, who was living nearby in Burrishall Lodge between Achill and Newport. Ernie O'Malley had been commander of the 2nd Southern Division of the IRA during the War of Independence, and later assistant chief of staff with the rank of general in the anti-treaty IRA during the Civil War. Graham recalled an anecdote about his Republican friend. I remember one day he said, we were walking on the strand on Achill Island, and I turned towards Ernie O'Malley and I said to him, Ernie, at what time is the tide? And he was about to answer when I saw a twinkle in his eyes of the old IRA man, never gives an information to the enemy. And he answered to Graham, well, Graham, that depends. It has been alleged that the friendship between Graham Greene and Ernie O'Malley, and the reason why they met in Achill, derived from the fact that both of them were Catherine Wollstone's lovers. A short while ago, I had the good fortune to meet in Dublin Ernie O'Malley's son, Cormac, who has scrupulously edited the papers of his father. He is extremely doubtful about the whole story. My premise, he said to me, is that there was indeed a close intellectual and family friendship from 1933 to 1957 between Ernie O'Malley and Catherine Wollstone. But Harry Wollstone would not have allowed Ernie O'Malley and myself to stay in Newton Hall from 1953 to 1956 if there had been the type of the relationship which has been suggested by William Cash and others. Indeed, I have found in my files references to my mother's slanderous comments about Ernie, Catherine, and several other women. She was confronted by Catherine Walston and Ernie O'Malley with Seaborn Rowntree and Liam Redmond as witnesses. She was threatened with legal action by Catherine Walston and backed off. In 1977, Green visited Belfast to make up his mind about the situation in Northern Ireland. He was horrified. "Since I was a teenager," he said, "I had a romantic leaning towards the old IRA of the 20s and the Irish struggle for independence. Today, the situation is very different. I don't see any similarity between the provisional IRA and the old IRA. There are no bonds between the terrorists of today and the idealists like Erskine Childers or Michael Collins, who were heroes in my youth." At the time, he was very tense because he said to me that he had at least three good reasons to be killed in Belfast. A, he was a Catholic. B, he was an Englishman. And C, he was a former agent of the SIS. So, on the other hand, he loathed the sectarianism and antiquated bigotry of the Reverend Ian Paisley. He would most probably have been puzzled to see in May 2007 the same Paisley, along with Martin McGuinness, a former commander of the Provisional IRA, being designated respectively as First Minister and Deputy First Minister of the Power Sharing Executive, born out of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. And he would have been no less flabbergasted to see a Conservative government in London forced, in order to remain in power, to rely on Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party, certainly the most parochial, reactionary and bigoted party in the whole United Kingdom. In 1977, Graham accepted to be member of the jury of the Edward Biggs Memorial Prize, named after the British ambassador who was murdered in Dublin by the IRA on the 21st of July 1976. This prize aimed at recognizing works promoting and encouraging peace and reconciliation in Ireland, under a greater understanding between the people of Britain and Ireland, and a closer cooperation between the partners of the European Community. They didn't anticipate the Brexit, obviously. Sitting with Graham Greene on the panel who judged the entries were Mayor Cruise O'Brien, the Irish poet and future Nobel Prize laureate Seamus Heaney, Georges Sion of the Belgian Royal Academy, the former French Foreign Minister Maurice Schumann, and the historian Thomas Pakenham. Very kindly, Graham suggested the scholarly journal of which I was the editor as a contender for the prize. "I proposed Études Irlandaises as one possible prize winner in the Edward Biggs affairs," he wrote to me on the 24th of October 1977. "But I'm afraid the majority favored two other books which were also on my shortlist. I think you should enter Études Irlandaises again next year." In 1978, he attempted to convince me to have another go. "I hope you will be entering Études Irlandaises again for the Edward Biggs Prize. A lot of very unsuitable books are being sent to me at the moment." But his efforts and mine once again bore no fruit. In January 77, I organized in Menton near the Franco-Italian border a session on Northern Ireland at the Académie de la Paix, a French think tank founded by the Nobel laureate René Cassin. The participants included Dr. Garrett Fitzgerald, who was then Minister for Foreign Affairs in Ireland, John Hume, Chairman of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland and future Peace Nobel Prize, and Jeremy Burchell, spokesperson of the Unionist Party. I published in Le Monde Diplomatique a summary of the discussions held in Menton. I sent a copy of the debates to Graham, who wrote to me, "I found the Menton conference of extreme interest. Your introduction was admirable, and I didn't wish to change a word. Fitzgerald and Hume were good and showed up the intransigence of Burchell. I wish this whole debate could be printed in English as a pamphlet. As far as literature was concerned, Graham considered Yeats as the greatest poet of his time. He admired Joyce, but more the short stories of Joyce rather than Ulysses or even Finnegan's Wake. He held the now almost forgotten George Birmingham to be one of the greatest humorists in the English language. He had all Birmingham's books in his library in Antibes, and he insisted that I should read The Search Party, which he assured me was a mini masterpiece. He was proud of being almost the sole writer who recognized the arrival of Flann O'Brien's first novel At Swims Two Birds. He was also very appreciative of Sean O'Fallon, with whom he had made an expedition to Joyce's Martello Tower in the 70s in Dublin. In another interview published in 1988 in a long-vanished French magazine called Speak Up, I asked Graham what made him choose Antibes and the south of France as his permanent residence. "Well, that goes into private life," he said. "I first came to Antibes shortly after the war, around 1946, and liked it very much. I used to come down to sail with Alexandre Corda, the film producer, a great friend of mine. He kept a boat in the harbor. I remember walking up the ramparts of Antibes. There was a nice house for sale, and I was rather tempted because I could have bought it at that time for the equivalent of £3,000. Unfortunately, I didn't. In 1959, some great friends of mine whom I had met in Africa came to live in Antibes." That was Jacques and Yvonne Cloeta. "Then, in 1961, I had a very bad attack of pneumonia, which I caught in Russia, and the doctor said that I ought to leave England during the winters. So I started to rent an apartment near the ramparts for 2 months at a time. Eventually, I got more and more tired of coming and going back and decided to reside permanently in Antibes. I made a point of coming by train, not by air, to mark the decision. And on January 1st, 1966, I settled here and bought a flat." It was on that exact day that Graham Greene was made a companion of honor in the Queen's New Year's Honours List. Graham did not mention to me that another reason to settle in the south of France was that he had to be domiciled in another country to avoid the consequences of a tax evasion scheme organized by his accountant Thomas Rowe, who embezzled his client's money, including Graham's, and had been arrested and sent to jail. "Did he miss England sometime?" To that question, he answered, "Well, I miss the English countryside, which I have always liked. I am very fond of Suffolk and Bury St. Edmunds, where there is a family brewery. But not to London, funnily enough. I was attached to London at the time of the war, during the Blitz, because there was a great spirit of comradeship. The only thing which I miss, really, are English draft beer and English sausages. Every time my wife Annick and I visited London, we would always go to Paxton and Whitfield at 93 German Street and buy a dozen sausages to bring back to our forlorn friend in the Residence des Fleurs." Normally shy and hesitant to meet strangers, Graham was surprisingly happy to accept my invitations to meet French and Irish friends eager to rub shoulders with him. I introduced him to Michel Déon of the Académie Française, a very fine writer, travel novelist, travel writer, and critic. They were amused to discover that they both went to visit Padre Pio in his retreat of San Giovanni Rotondo. Michel Déon wrote, incidentally, a lovely piece on the human factor when it was translated into French. I also introduced my English friend to Paul Guimard and his wife, the feminist writer Benoît Groult, both good friends of François Mitterrand, and to Michel Mort, another very fine writer, a member of the Académie Française, who was also the eminence grise of translations from English at Gallimard, the prestigious French publishing house. These encounters were sometimes fascinating, and at other times, a disastrous flop. One evening we spent with our close friend René Jean Dupuis, who was a master of international law, having been the rector of the Academy of International Law in La Hague, member of the Collège de France and of the Académie des Sciences Morales et Politiques, was such a disastrous flop. Dupuis, a devoted Catholic, was a huge admirer of the power and the glory. Graham was in somber mood, and the conversation went astray. It started by an over-enthusiastic reference by our friend to the strange world known as Greenland. Graham reacted as if he had been bitten by a mosquito. Once one has seen a dead child in a ditch in Vietnam or Mexico in the time of religious persecutions, or being confronted with the atrocity in Haiti under Papa Doc or Cuba under Batista, one is no longer inventing fictions called The Quiet American or The Power and the Glory or The Comedians or Our Man in Havana. There is no such place as Greenland. It is only the world as it is. The next question put to him was about his description as a Catholic writer, to which Graham replied curtly, "I don't know what a Catholic writer is. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a writer who happens to be a Catholic. That's all." To alleviate the discomfort, I said jokingly, "Graham, you remind me of Brendan Behan, who once said, 'I am not a writer with a drinking problem. I am a drunkard with a writing problem.'" And now, it was insufficient to salvage the evening. Graham particularly relished the Irish gift of the gab. At a dinner party at the Villa Dina, he particularly enjoyed the company of Patrick Campbell, 3rd Baron Glenavy, regular contributor to the Irish Times and the Sunday Times, team leader of the BBC television programme Call My Bluff, and writer of many hilarious books. He was the most extraordinary wit to have come out of Ireland, a country which has produced so many throughout the centuries. Frank Muir has penned a lovely portrait of this exceptional Dublin character. Patrick Campbell, unbelievably tall, a few choice hairs, the colour of a Kellogg's cornflakes, eyes as close together as a pair of cufflinks, a slight tendency to drift sideways when walking, like a young lost crab. When surprised, would rear up, eyes rounded, the picture of an ostrich which has sat in something. His stories told of the tiny agonies and embarrassments of life, so huge at the time, and he told them plainly, sometimes rather sadly, with a rare grace of style. He was, I think, the humorist's humorist. Graham so much enjoyed this cultured wit, who stuttered the most funny stories about the strangeness and foolishness of human nature, that the evening lasted until well past 4 o'clock in the morning, which was very unusual for Graham. I also introduced him to the then Taoiseach, Prime Minister of Ireland, Garret Fitzgerald, a charming intellectual who exerted a profound modernizing influence on his country, and eventually managed to persuade Margaret Thatcher into signing the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 1985, now regarded as the first step of the Northern Ireland peace process. Graham told me on many occasions that he had been very impressed by the moral stature and political acumen of Garret Fitzgerald. Incidentally, it was Garret Fitzgerald who had appointed me Honorary Consul of Ireland in September 1973, which indeed shows his political acumen. Because I knew that he had been a great film buff, I always invited the scriptwriter of The Third Man to the parties that I was organizing during the Cannes Film Festival whenever there was an Irish film in the official competition. Around the swimming pool of Le Chêne Vert, Graham recalled his foray into the movies with professionals like Seamus Smith, managing directors of the National Film Studios of Ireland, and John Boorman, the British film director who now lives in County Wicklow and who is regarded as the godfather of Irish cinema. In 1981, at such a party, I conceived the ambitious project to reconcile Graham Greene and Anthony Burgess, both good friends of mine, who made no secret of their mutually intense dislike for each other. I have a photograph of the two expatriate British writers with me in the middle, looking like an anxious firefighter caught between a lit torch and a stick of dynamite. It all went well, though. They were polite and courteous to each other, but their reconciliation remained as elusive as the reconciliation between Unionists and Republicans in Northern Ireland. They were probably too far apart. Graham, the epitome of the Englishman, introvert, shy, and self-restrained. Anthony, extrovert, proud of his Irish ancestry, always restless and talking with machine gun speed. One was an island, the other a volcano. One worshipped Henry James, the other James Joyce. Graham pretended that he could not read Burgess without the help of a dictionary. Of the author of A Clockwork Orange, Graham thought, like Disraeli of Gladstone, that he was inebriated by the exuberance of his own verbosity. Last but not least, the two men were divided by the same faith. Burgess was born a Catholic and accused Graham, the convert, of theological arrogance. For Burgess, Greene was something much worse than a Protestant, a hidden Jansenist. Alas, my two friends did not bury the hatchet of war on this side of the grave. I hope they have made their peace in another world. At this time, Graham was disturbed, obsessed, and enraged by the messy separation between Martine, the daughter of Yvelin Cloetta, the last great passion of his life, and a local businessman with a criminal record and shady connections. Eventually, a legally questionable divorce by mutual consent was obtained, but under conditions of exceptional duress. Martin had to live within a radius of 500 meters of her husband's home. She was forbidden to work after 8 p.m. She could not take her children to visit their grandparents in Juan-les-Pins. Furthermore, her husband started to make life intolerable for her and for her parents. He brutalized his former wife, spirited away their six-year-old daughter, threatened to blow Evan's brain out, and assaulted Jacques Cloetta, Martin's father. All these incidents were duly but unavailingly reported to the police. The young woman, her parents, and Graham were engulfed in a climate of blackmail, intimidation, and violence that was exacerbated daily. Martin's husband even managed to secure temporary custody of the couple's daughter. The situation was so blatantly biased that Graham contemplated publishing an article or a book on police corruption and dysfunctional courts on the French Riviera. I dissuaded him by introducing him to my friend Pierre Merly, mayor of Antibes and member of the French Parliament, who promised to help. I wrote to the préfet, head of the services of the state in the département, who duly forwarded my letter to Paris. A meeting followed between Graham and the Minister of Justice, Alain Perfit, and this initiated an internal inquiry into the functioning of the judiciary in Nice. While some remedial measures were implemented, they did not materially impact the sorry state of affairs of Martine. In May 1981, François Mitterrand was elected president, and following the subsequent victory of the socialists at the general election, a left-wing government was formed in Paris. I heard that my friend, the writer Paul Guimard, had been appointed advisor to the president with an office at the Élysée. I contacted him and made another plea for help. Graham was received by the new socialist minister for justice, Robert Badinter, who promised to act swiftly. But the situation remained largely unchanged. No one could curb the arrogance of Martin's ex-husband and the violence of his campaign of attrition. Graham then decided to resort to his initial plans, making the whole story public in the international press. On the 31st of January 1982, the Sunday Times published a full page on Graham Greene's private war in the south of France. Shortly afterwards, appeared a 69 pages long bilingual pamphlet entitled J'accuse, The Dark Side of Nice. This was published by Bodley Head under Graham's signature. The first two sentences were a bombshell. Let me issue a warning to anyone who is tempted to settle for a peaceful life on what is called the Côte d'Azur. Avoid the region of Nice, which is the preserve of some of the most criminal organizations in the south of France. All the details of the case were disclosed, and the conclusion of the pamphlet was uncompromising. I accuse certain police officers in Nice of protecting criminals, of encouraging them in their crimes, by granting them immunity, whether for the sake of the information they provide or for money and favors. I accuse certain magistrates of having deliberately shut their eyes to a problem concerning the emotional stability of two children. Graham's accusation made world headlines. Hundreds of journalists swamped the capital of the French Riviera. The author of J'accuse gave countless interviews. He was vilified in some papers, eulogized in others. The media battle raged for days. At first, it seemed that Graham had gone too far. His pamphlet was declared defamatory and banned by a French tribunal, and another court forced him, his publisher, and some newspapers to pay libel damages. In the end, however, the weapon proved effective. Martin was given the custody of her children, she went to live in Switzerland, and the troublemaker was subdued. In a letter to his publisher, Max Reinhardt, Graham said of his pamphlet, "I feel it has served its purpose and we have won most of our case." My involvement in the affair was acknowledged by both sides. I received one day an anonymous phone call conveying an obvious threat: mind your own business and stop giving stupid counsels to Mr. Green. Graham gave me a limited edition of his book, How Father Kicksart Became a Monsignor, with this inscription on the first page: for Pierre and Annick, in the hope that one day I can do a little for you compared with what you have done for us. I was and am intensely moved by this expression of gratitude, even though I knew that my efforts have been ineffectual. In the end, victory belonged to what Father Leopoldo Duran called the incalculable power of one man's pen. I was also involved in another controversy that took place towards the end of Graham's life. At the end of 1988, I had received a phone call from my friend Sean Donlon, who had been Irish ambassador in Washington and also Secretary General of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs, before joining as Executive Vice President the Shannon-based company Guinness Peace Aviation. This thriving company, set up by Dr. Tony Ryan, was then the world's largest commercial aircraft sales and leasing company. Dr. Tony Ryan, who also co-founded the low-cost airlines company Ryanair, was a philanthropist with an active interest in university education, culture, and the fine arts. His company had launched a GPA book award with a prize money of 50,000 Irish pounds, making it among the world's richest literary prizes. Sean Donlon requested me to help him to get, I quote, "the best known living writer in the English language" to be the adjudicator. To have Graham Greene would give the award an immediate importance and distinction in the world of letters. Knowing that Graham was my friend, Donlon asked me to approach him to see if he would accept to be the first adjudicator of the GPA Book Award. What was a simple and straightforward agreement between all parties was later on distorted, and reports started to appear in the media accusing Graham of all the sins in the world. The worst attack came from the pen of the administrator of the award, Jerry Dukes, then a lecturer in English at Mary Immaculate College, a teacher training college in Limerick. His petulant denunciation of Graham Greene's unforgivable deviousness was published in the letter section of the London Review of Books on July 7, 1994. My answer followed in the issue of the 22nd of September 1994. I take the liberty to quote it in full. I recently came across the funny article by Colin Toybin entitled How Many Nipples Had Graham Greene? But I was much less amused by the subsequent letter by Jerry Dukes on the role of Graham Greene as adjudicator of the GPA Literary Award. Jerry Dukes had only just been appointed as literary administrator of the prize, with no responsibilities whatsoever for its financial aspects, nor any involvement with Graham Greene's preconditions as adjudicator. Having given the false impression that he had some say in these matters, he goes overboard to the point of misrepresentation. As a matter of fact, Graham Greene had accepted, to my great surprise, to be the adjudicator of the GPA Literary Prize on the condition that he might be allowed to award the prize to Vincent MacDonald, the young Irish author of a novel entitled The Broken Commandments, which he had read in manuscript and which had moved him so much that he had convinced his friend Max Reinhardt to publish it. Sean Donnellan accepted this condition without discussion and flew down to Nice shortly afterwards. In my house, in the Cap d'Antibes, details were finalized between Graham Greene, Sean Donnellan, and myself. It was agreed that two lists of books would be established, a long list in which the name of Vincent MacDonald would appear, and a short list selected by a panel of literary assessors. Graham would be free to choose the winner out of one or the other list. Sean Donnellan didn't seem to find this term unusual, and there was nothing he did not fully comprehend. On the contrary, he found them to be totally acceptable and indeed confirmed them in writing with the briefest of delays. He sent a letter to Graham and he sent me the copy of the letter, and I mean, it is clear that the understanding was absolutely clear and perfect. However, after having received the books shortlisted by the panel of assessors, Graham rang me to say that he was extremely embarrassed. While he still thought that Vincent MacDonald's talents deserved recognition, he also praised the Book of Evidence by John Banville. Wouldn't it be possible, he asked, to split the £50,000 prize in two in order to award two prizes instead of one? I got in touch with Sean Donnellan, who spontaneously made the offer to create a first fiction prize of £20,000 to be awarded to Vincent MacDonald, while the main GPA Literary Award would be given to John Banville. Graham heartily welcomed this generous move, which assuaged his scruples. The matter was thus sold right from the outset to everybody's satisfaction, without the help of Jerry Dukes, who was never in the position at any stage to have to sell anything to GPA. In pretending that he was the fixer in this matter, he commits the sin of vanity of which he accuses Graham. Indeed, if Jerry Dukes found the proceeding so distasteful, why did he not disassociate himself from the entire affair and return GPA's check? Despite ill-informed rumors spread by people who knew nothing of the straightforward nature of this accord, there was never at any time the slightest hint of disagreement between GPA and Graham. No pressure was ever exerted by one on the other. It is true, however, that Graham was extremely tired prior to his departure, and in spite of the comfort of his travel arrangements, he returned to Antibes in a state of near exhaustion. Having escorted him on this visit to County Tipperary and Dublin, where he received an exceptionally warm welcome from Dr. Tony Ryan, chairman of GPA, and his team, may I say that it was only too obvious that Graham was putting a brave face on it, despite his considerable discomfort and pain. If Jerry Dukes failed to notice Graham's state of health, I'm sorry for his lack of sensitivity. Far from receiving the cold shoulder treatment that one would have normally expected in the circumstances described so inaccurately by your correspondent, Graham was given a standing ovation by all the people gathered for the awards ceremony in the House of Lords of the old 18th century Irish Parliament on College Green. Now, Jerry Dukes may have resented this ovation. He may even have remained seated in protest at what he described rather bluntly as the vanity, foolishness, mischievousness, absence of integrity of the grand old man of English letters. If he did so, I must say that his dissent was so discreet that it went unnoticed. His acrimonious letter, of the kind that we call in France le coup de pied de l'âne, only confirms what Jonathan Swift once said: when a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign that the dunces are all in confederacy against him. End of quote. Sean Donnellan was also upset by this petty campaign of denigration, but the former Irish ambassador was more courteous and couched his disapproval in more diplomatic terms than I did. "I am at a loss," he said, "to explain the discrepancy between my account of Green and the GPA Book Award and accounts which have appeared elsewhere, suggesting an element of Green mischief, particularly in relation to giving the prize to MacDonald. In my conversations with Green during his 3 days in Ireland, he frequently commented favorably on Banville's writing, with which he seemed to be familiar. He also expressed great admiration for Seamus Heaney. In donating his own fee to MacDonald, he was signifying his personal support for a young writer whose first book he had arranged to have published. It was a generous and straightforward gesture. Like so many things in Green's life, there had to be an element of mystery and room for controversy." Of this short journey to Ireland with Graham and Yvonne, I keep in mind three lasting memories: the transfer by helicopter from Dublin Airport to Kilboy House in County Tipperary, where we received the warmest welcome from Tony Ryan and Lady Miranda Ivy; Graham's appreciation of the standing ovation he received in the upper house of the old Irish Parliament of College Green, following which he said to me, tongue-in-cheek, it's better than to receive the Nobel Prize; and the pilgrimage to the grave of Jonathan Swift in St. Patrick's Cathedral. I have no doubt that Graham would have been only too happy to carve for himself the Latin epitaph of the mad dean, which I give in translation: "Here lies the body of Jonathan Swift, Doctor of Divinity and Dean of this cathedral, where savage indignation can no longer lacerate his heart. Go, traveller, and imitate, if you can, this dedicated and earnest champion of liberty." He died on the 19th of October, 1745, aged 78 years. Back in Antibes, I was dismayed to find that Graham's health was deteriorating rapidly. We learned later that he was suffering from leukemia and needed a series of blood transfusions. He was becoming more and more feeble. He could eat very little. Our encounters were shorter, but no less cordial for that. I met him for the last time in September 1990, shortly before he left for Switzerland to be near his daughter and close to the hospital and doctor who was treating him. On this last occasion, there were no dry martinis, no Jameson whiskies. But if we were on the dry, the conversation was as fascinating as ever. I asked him if he knew that his good friend Norman Douglas had lived in Antibes in 1941, renting a room at number 1 Place Massé, now Place de Gaulle. He smiled gently and rose to his feet to get a book on the shelves of his library. It was a 500 pages biography of Norman Douglas, written by Mark Holloway and published in 1976 by Secker and Warburg in London. He handed it to me, saying, You will find all the details in this book. Please keep it as a souvenir. Shortly afterwards, we parted on the landing of the fourth floor of the Résidence des Fleurs. I knew that most probably I would never see him again. When I arrived home, I opened the Norman Douglas biography, which Graham had given me as a sort of farewell present. I was overcome to see that it had been offered to him by none other than Catherine Walston, his great love, who had inspired the end of the affair before Yvonne's time. It was inscribed in red ink, "To Graham for Christmas 1976. What fun lunches we had with those three, one especially, love, Catherine." Underneath, Graham had scribbled in his minuscule handwriting, "Yes, indeed," followed by the names Norman, Kenneth, and Polly. From between the pages fell a photograph of Norman Douglas smoking his pipes in Capri, and a card reproducing the portrait of the artist's brother Diego by Alberto Giacometti. It had a strange resemblance to Graham. Catherine Walston, on the reverse, had written these few lines, dated 14 December 1976. "Dearest Graham, I don't like your watercolour in the Times, but I dare say it's hard to reproduce a watercolour in a newspaper. I really like this picture of you, and if I had any money and it was not in the USA collection, I would have bought it. Don't you like it? But then, on the whole, I like Giacometti, especially when it looks like you. I hope you have not already bought this book. I read it first, as I am too broke to buy two copies. Love, Catherine." On the 25th of October, Graham Greene left Antibes, never to return. After having received a book that I had edited on Dublin from the years 1904 to 1924, he dropped me a note on the 4th of March, 1 month before he died, saying, "I am stuck here, indefinitely forbidden to travel, so as to be near the doctor and hospital who are treating me. I look forward to reading your own book, but it will take me a long time to read, as my eyes are bad and I read very little at a time. We miss you and Annick, and hope that we shall see you again before too long, but I don't expect to be back in Antibes for some month, if then. Lots of love to you both, Graham." They were his last words to my wife and me, like a friendly wave of the hand, sending a discreet goodbye. 3 days later, he sent a farewell letter to the mayor of Antibes, Pierre Merly. "It is with great sadness that I am writing this letter to tell you that I have been forced to change my residence from France to Switzerland because of my health. For 2 years now, I have been living between one blood transfusion and another, close to the hospital and the doctor who has been treating me since my first attack when I was visiting my daughter here. But there seems to be little hope for change. I am strictly forbidden to travel. Indeed, it is not easy for me to walk more than a few yards on my own. I was very happy in Antibes, the only town on the Côte d'Azur where I could have borne to live, because we had a mayor who preserved the character of the town morally and architecturally. I am keeping my flat there in the rather vain hope that one day I may be able to return." It was a forlorn hope, as Graham knew only too well. He died, aged 86, on the 3rd of April, 1991. However, it was not quite the end of my association with the man who, for 25 years, had been writing in longhand, in front of the sea and the Fort Carré, such masterpieces as "Can We Borrow Your Husband?", "Travels with My Aunt," "A Sort of Life," "The Honorary Consul," his favorite novel, "The Human Factor," "Dr. Fisher of Geneva," "Ways of Escape," "Monsignor Quixot," "The Captain and the Enemy," etc. With the encouragement of the mayor of Antibes, the support of the family, and the help of a dedicated friend, I set up a major exhibition on Graham's life and works at the Picasso Museum in the historical Chateau Grimaldi, overlooking the ramparts of Antibes. Launched on the 2nd of October 1992 to coincide with Graham's birthday, this moving tribute, scheduled for 1 month, was so successful that it was extended until the end of December. Apart from exhibits borrowed from the British Council and the Edition Robert Laffont, there was a rich selection of private letters, manuscripts, books, paintings, limited editions, poems, decorations such as the Order of Merit bestowed upon him by Queen Elizabeth II, mementos of his journeys to Russia and South America, rare photographs and personal belongings lent by the family and close friends. Particularly moving was the display of the manuscript of A World of My Own, a dream diary which had not yet been published at the time, and of a small piece of paper on which Graham had scribbled his five last written words, In Search of a Beginning. All these memorabilia had never been before seen in public and will most certainly not be seen again. On 18th of September 1992, a marble plaque bearing the words Graham Greene lived here from 1966 to 1990 was unveiled by Mayor Pierre Merly, Yvan Cloetta and myself on the facade of the Résidence des Fleurs, 26 Avenue Pasteur. It is now a literary landmark establishing Antibes as the capital of Greenland, this elusive playground of a great writer who furnished us with his distinctive blend of the nightmare of history and the aspiration to justice of an inquisitive mind. Thank you.
Use this. Can anyone actually hear me? Can you hear me? Is that all right? Do you have a question? Oh.
Thank you very much for that. Truly enlightening in so many ways. As we had Vincent's own account.
Yes, I saw that
last year. It was particularly interesting to hear what you had to say about the prize. And you're really correcting the Norman Sherry account of that. We're really on the search for corrections to that biography, and certainly I think exactly what you've said there does correct a lot of wrong impressions of that particular episode. And anyone who's looked at that picture. There's a photograph of the group, and you only have to look at Graham to know that he was far from well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you mentioned Norman Sherry. I must say that I resent extraordinarily the fact that he never tried to get in touch with me. He knew of my existence. I'm quoted in the book. I'm quoted in the book, actually it's very curious because I'm quoted at the beginning of the chapter concerning the GPA Literary Prize, but for one reason or another I didn't make it to the index. I was lost in between. Knowing that I was behind the whole scheme of this GPA Literary Prize, the least that he would have had to do was to contact me to get my view on the situation. He never got in touch with me. And I don't know if you have read three volumes of his biography. Incidentally, I remember one day Graham, in a furious state of mind, said to me, three volumes of 800 pages, not even Stalin deserves that. So, and I suspect, I may be wrong, I may be right, I don't know what's your opinion, but I suspect that Norman Sherry had a very bizarre and curious love-hate relationship with his subject. And the love is obviously in the first volume, a little bit in the second volume, but in the third volume it's rather the hate rather than love. And I have a very quick anecdote to tell you. Yvonne Cloetta once told me that after an interview with Graham that had gone very badly, Graham had been quite severely with Norman Sherry. Well, Norman Sherry got in the car with Yvonne, and he cried over the shoulder of Yvonne, saying, "But Graham doesn't realize that I have sacrificed my life to him." And when Graham was told that by Yvonne, he said, "Well, I didn't ask for it." So, I must say that I resent very much the one-sided view spread by Jerry Dukes and by Norman Sherry. And they didn't go to interview Sean Donlan. They didn't go to interview me. They didn't go to interview Dr. Tony Ryan. They only listened to the last foot soldiers on the ground, which I think is very infuriating.
I wonder if I could just... we're heading towards birthday toast time, but can I ask a question which you may not be able to answer very briefly, but about the whole Jacques Hughes episode, that whole thing. Clearly it was a time when Green was under an enormous amount of pressure.
Absolutely.
And in personal danger for some of that time. When the whole thing was resolved, when you know the thing went through the courts and the whole episode had died down, did he ever reflect on that whole thing, on his managing of it, of his publishing of the Jacques? What was his take on?
Well,
on
actually,
those years?
Actually, I was very much against the publishing of Jacques. But in the end, I had to confess that it was the right move, because it's only the publishing of Jacques which made things moved at last. I think that Graham clearly intended and clearly saw the pamphlet as a weapon, not as anything more than that. I mean, I always laughed with him. I said, "Look, Graham, you're pushing the ball a bit far, because Nice is not worse than Marseille or Paris or London, and it's not a hideaway for all the gangsters of the world and things like that." Well, he said, "I know it, but I had to use." The exocet. I had to use the big cannon to get things moving. And I mentioned this letter he wrote to Max Reinhardt to say, "Well, this pamphlet has been useful. It has reached most of our goals." And in that same letter, he says, "I don't want to see it." Well, actually, it was to have it published in another country under its translation. And Graham was not in favor of that. He didn't consider it as one of his major work. There was no doubt. Having been strongly against, having disapproved at the beginning the whole move, I said in the end, "Graham, you were right from the beginning." When you have only one weapon left, you have to use it.
Right, we should move now to birthday toast. Before Pierre proposes that toast, can I, on your behalf, thank him for such a thorough coverage of the year that you've given and the insight that he's given to. Thank you very much.